From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The struggle to protect water resources from extractive industries is not over with the approval of the Dakota Access Pipeline in Standing Rock, North Dakota. A delegation of Indigenous women leaders is globalizing their activism, traveling to Europe to push for financial divestment from pipeline projects. The women have been meeting with political leaders and representatives in banking and insurance in countries like Norway, Switzerland, and Germany to demand that nations with high standards for human rights refuse to fund extractive industries in the United States, especially when the impacts of those industries are felt most by Indigenous and vulnerable communities. The Indigenous Women's Divestment Delegation includes LaDonna Brave Bull Allard. She's the founder of the Sacred Stone Camp and a member of the Standing Rock Tribe. Tara Hauska, a tribal attorney, former advisor on Native American Affairs to Bernie Sanders, as well as my guest, Michelle Cook, an Indigenous human rights lawyer, a current SJD candidate at the University of Arizona's Indigenous Peoples Law and Policy Program. She's writing her dissertation on international law, Indigenous peoples' human rights, gender, sexuality, and Indigenous transnationalism. And she's a founding member of the Water Protector Legal Collective, the on-the-ground legal team, which provides legal services to those arrested at the Standing Rock encampment. She now joins me from Italy. Welcome to the program, Michelle.
Thank you so much for having me.
So explain how this started, how you and this handful of women, Indigenous women leaders, decided to do this, to leave the United States to protect U.S. water.
My journey at Standing Rock began in August. I had the honor and privilege of being able to help the camps create a legal infrastructure and legal support. And during that time, I was also, as a human rights lawyer, observing and writing statements about the human rights situations that were occurring before my very eyes. And in October, I had got a call from an individual in Amsterdam who heard that I was working with the Water Protector Legal Collective and asked if we had any reports that would be able to verify evidence of human rights violations that were occurring. So we were able to compile a report about the human rights violations in Standing Rock, and we were very fortunate that our Sami brothers and sisters in Norway needed that report when they were meeting with the bank DNB in Norway. So thankfully, we were able to get them that report. Our Sami relatives were able to use $1 million from the project. However, this bank, DNB, still maintained their loans to the project. And so myself and other individuals, we said that is just not good enough. What else can we do? So as a critical legal scholar, we're always taught that the most powerful message that we can deliver is always from the impacted people themselves, to give people who are impacted by these extractive industries the opportunity to speak for themselves. So we were able to then, I was able to contact We Can, which is a wonderful organization. And I talked to Osprey, who is the founder, and I said, you know, I really think that we need to bring women to these banking institutions so that they can tell their own stories and so that we can advocate for divestment not only from the project of the Dakota Access Pipeline, but also we should be asking these banks to exclude these companies who are behaving in such a way that they are violating Indigenous people's human rights. So after months of work, we were able to organize the delegation and to bring a delegation in March. And then we followed up with another delegation most recently.
So how is it that these projects here in the United States are being funded or being insured by so many companies in Europe? Is that the main reason that took you to Europe, that you found that there were a lot of companies that were putting money into projects whose impacts they are very far away from geographically?
Absolutely. So one of the best advice that I can give any Indigenous person who is facing extraction and development in their territory is to follow the money. And so we followed the money. Also, you know, we were able to get that wonderful graph from Hugh McMillan at Food and Water Watch, which illustrated all of the 17 banks that were funding the project. And many of those banks are international financial institutions or international banks. So we said, we need to go there. We need to talk directly to these bank representatives, and we need to hold them accountable to their own human rights policies that their banks have. And so we were able to go and do that.
So just a quick aside on the Dakota Access Pipeline, some who had been following that story here in the United States might imagine that that struggle is over, but is it?
No. And if we listen to LaDonna Brave Bull Allard, who is the founder and the heart, really, in my opinion, of this movement, she says, you know, we continue to stand. We continue to stand, and that Standing Rock is just the beginning. And had Standing Rock not happened, I know that I would have never began to engage in these financial systems and banks to learn and to gain the knowledge of how these banks that may be located 5,000 miles away directly impact Indigenous peoples' rights all over the world. And so now that Indigenous peoples have that knowledge, and now that we are developing a methodology and an expectation within the banking industry that if these banks are going to fund extractive industries in our territories that violate our people's human rights and our cultural survival, then they can expect for Indigenous peoples to ask not only for accountability for those harms, but for divestment from those projects and from those companies.
So you went there to warn them of the consequences of their actions that might come back to haunt them.
Absolutely. I mean, we are all responsible for our actions, no matter who we are. And that is also true for banks. Unfortunately, banks listen to money, and so do corporations. And it is their own choice if they would want to invite reputational risk to their institution for the decisions that they are making. That is, they have the duty and the responsibility to mitigate their clients' conduct. When they are notified and they find out that there's human rights violations, they have a duty, a human duty, to say, stop. What are you doing, client? Why are you doing this? This is unacceptable behavior. So we need banks to mitigate the conduct of their clients when their clients are violating human rights standards. And in the United States, we should not accept that this company, Energy Transfer Partnership, was allowed to treat not only Indian people in such an egregious way, but also American citizens. It's not just a problem for Indian country and Indian people when corporations are allowed to abuse human beings this way. It's also a problem for United States citizens, and it's a problem for our global civil society. It's a problem for our world. So we have to find ways to keep people accountable. And where there are no mechanisms of accountability, it is our duty as Indigenous peoples and as civil society to create these mechanisms ourselves. And so the delegation is very much the creation of mechanisms of accountability for our people, to give our people a platform to be able to speak directly with decision makers and tell them, this needs to stop. Enough is enough.
So tell us about some of the people that you met with in countries like Norway and Switzerland, Germany, or now in Italy. I understand you spoke with elected politicians, members of parliaments, but also with representatives from these financial institutions that are funding or might be funding some of these projects like the Dakota Access Pipeline. Who did you meet with?
So in Norway, we were able to meet with bank representatives at DNB. We were also able to meet with the Norwegian Pension Fund or the Norwegian Sovereign Fund, which is one of the largest investors in oil and gas in the world. And so we were able to meet with their ethics committee. We were able to say, you know, you have this ethics policy that says that your pension fund will not invest in companies violating human rights. We have clear and discrete human rights violations that occurred in North Dakota. And so we want you to continue to exclude companies that are responsible for this type of behavior. We also gave that same message to Credit Suisse as well as UBS in Switzerland. And we were also able to meet with Bayer and LB in Germany as well as Deutsche Bank in Germany.
Wow. What were the responses of some of these folks? And was there a difference between responses depending on if you were talking to elected officials versus actual representatives of these banking institutions?
The elected officials that we were able to meet with are very supportive. Mm. They want to know how to help Indian people. If you speak with most people in Europe, many individuals in Europe support Indian people, love Indian people, and do not want their money to be funding cultural genocide elsewhere in the world. When we talked to parliament members, especially in Norway, they were very receptive, very helpful to our cause. However, you know, when we meet with some banks are very problematic. In the case of DNB, for example, they did their own due diligence and their own investigation, which found that there was violations of Indigenous people's free prior informed consent. They took a very small step, but a very positive step. This is not the case of UBS or Credit Suisse. Neither of those companies, to my knowledge, have made any mitigation efforts that are publicly visible. And it matters that these banks make small steps that are public because it sends a message. It sends a message to the banking industry when we have other banks saying, this is creating a risk for us that we cannot abide. So there's different types of attitudes and responses that we've gotten from these different banks. And we're going to continue to work not only with the individuals in the banks that have been supportive, but we're also going to continue to pressure the banks that have not been receptive because they too have an obligation and a duty to support Indigenous people's human rights and to mitigate the abuse of those rights when they are notified.
Michelle, was it sort of important for the people that you spoke with to meet you and your fellow delegates face to face, right? Because it's easy for a corporate boardroom to make decisions or CEOs to make decisions about things that don't impact them personally, about things that they have the luxury of not thinking about in human terms, that these are decisions that impact human beings. But then when they have to come face to face with someone who's telling them, your bottom line is hurting my community, it's a whole different thing, isn't it?
Absolutely. They need to understand that Indian people are a strong people. They need to understand that Indigenous peoples throughout the world are protecting the last remnants of biodiversity on this planet. They also need to understand that we are a powerful people. We are a powerful people. And when we are able to go in those meetings and we are able to show them our strength, not only to show them strength, but to show them the truth, to show them the facts, and then we give it to them and we say, either you can take this information and you can do something good with it, or if you want to continue to deny that this happened, that is your own reputational risk that you are inviting not only to your bank and to your institution, but to your own personal self. It is the reputational risk that we are pressuring. It's not only important, though, for the banks to see us. I think it's most important that we see the bank, that we see the people who are responsible for these decisions. I was there the day that the women and the people were attacked September 3rd, and they were bitten by dogs that were hired by Energy Transfer Partnership. I will always have that memory in my mind. And when I saw those people bitten by dogs, I asked myself, who helped make this happen? Who did this? And so we followed the money and we found the people who were in charge of making these decisions. And for my own sense of justice, for my own sense of healing, for my own ability to feel effective, I needed to see who these people were. And so for me, it is incredibly powerful for us to sit across from the table with one another, to sit in the spirit of civil dialogue, to speak with one another and say, this is wrong. See me. See that I am a human being. See that there is pain here and that there is suffering, and do something about it. Very simple.
Michelle, did you show the people you met with images and videos of what took place last year in Standing Rock? And also, do you feel that your meetings are having an impact? Any firm commitments to divest yet?
Yes, we were able to show much of the visual legal evidence that has been collected by many of the media people who were at camp. So they have seen the dog bite, the dog bites. They have seen use of excessive force by the police. They have seen images of the protesters being shot with water cannons in sub-zero degree weather. So we were able to bring all of those images and visuals to these representatives. We don't have many commitments. In my opinion, I haven't seen any commitments from any of these banks to exclude energy transfer partners for the human rights violations. Now, we have a lot of banks who have said we're not going to finance the project Dakota Access Pipeline, but very few of those institutions, none of those institutions, to my knowledge, have said we're going to stop working with this actor because of the behavior and the conduct of this client.
So the struggle is still a long way off.
Yes, we are still working because we have the evidence, we have the visuals, we have the information. They have enough information that they should be able to make the right decision. And in my opinion, this divestment movement is just beginning, but it's also something that we are still working on, and it's also a movement that has been initiated by other Indigenous people, such as the late Arthur Manuel from First Nations. He was definitely a trailblazer in the arena of divestment, as well as looking into the insurance companies and their role in the extraction of resources in Indigenous people's territories.
And there's, of course, a divestment movement here in the U.S. as well that is quite active in many sort of local communities, people taking on banks in their communities and demanding that they divest from the Dakota Access Pipeline and other projects as well, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. One of our delegates who was able to come with us, Ms. Jacqueline Fielder, she is one of the founders of Mazaska Talks, mazaskatalks.org. And this is an Indigenous-led grassroots movement to create municipal and city divestment from these banks that are not only invested in Indigenous human rights violations, but are invested in private prisons and other activity that that violates human rights around the world. And so that work is continuing, and we're very happy to have individuals like Jackie from Mazaska Talks to create campaigns such as Divest the Globe. This is one of the current campaigns that's happening, in fact, October 23rd through 25th, that individuals throughout the world can participate in. And so there's more information about that campaign on mazaskatalks.org that people can find out how they can influence how they can divest their cities, how they can divest themselves from these banks that are responsible for this type of egregious behavior.
Well, Michelle, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and for spending this time with us. Appreciate it.
Excellent. And thank you so much for having us. We really appreciate your time and your help for our cause.
My guest is Michelle Cook, speaking with us from Italy. She's an Indigenous human rights lawyer, a current SJD candidate at the University of Arizona's Indigenous Peoples Law and Policy Program, and a founding member of the Water Protector Legal Collective. And we've been discussing her recent trip to Europe with members of the Indigenous Women's Divestment Delegation. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.